Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 68, where Tom, Ralph, Leonardo, and Dimitris are discussing the 2019 documentary film American Factory, directed by Stephen Bognar and Julie Reichert. In part two, we continue our analysis of the film and its possible implications for the future of work. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So in part one, we covered what the film was about, as well as some of the main themes and concepts that come through, including things to do with the management of change, things to do with intercultural conflict, but also conflict of the state of thinking about management science and what are the priorities to do with that, whether you prioritize outputs or you prioritize worker safety and well-being and so on and so forth. There is a lot that comes through in this film that would be of supreme interest to students of management, and we would absolutely urge you, if you educate any of those, to suggest this film. So in this part, we probably want to delve a little bit into more detail with respect to specific aspects and practices. And something that maybe we can start with is to do with a perennial topic in management, which is motivation, right? So there is a couple of scenes, in this film, one of which features American workers as they are contemplating, still at that point, contemplating unionization. And they're complaining that, well, as Ralph alluded to this episode in part one, that Chinese managers are a bit rough around the edges. They tell them what to do. They don't explain why. They do not answer why questions. And they're quick to penalize. And the person recounting this experience goes on to say that, well, I really like working with my colleagues on the shop floor. I like working with my hands. I like this job. But we're not getting patted on the back. No one's coming in and saying, hey, great job. So that's indicating the aspects of intrinsic motivation that we know from people like Hertzberg, that yes, there are factors to do with how the workplace is set up, whether people get paid enough, whether it's safe. And then there's factors that have more to do with psychological comfort and in what people value in their jobs. And American employees who are in that meeting, they very clearly indicate that this type of camaraderie that they perhaps had at the GM plant or that they're longing for is clearly missing there. Cut forward to a meeting of a Chinese manager with many of the same American workers, where he's announcing that you guys are lucky today because everyone in this room is going to get $2 extra per hour for their work, and everyone's pretty happy. And then comes the caveat, but you need to work longer and you need to work harder. And by the way, you probably shouldn't unionize as well. And then the room is just silent. There is no sign of jubilation. There's no sign of celebration because it really dawns on everyone that this isn't a raise for the work that they've been putting in. This isn't an acknowledgement of how well they're doing or the sacrifices that they're making. It's a bribe. It's a very obvious bribe from the management to prevent unionization. And you can see how that just kills morale on the spot.
And it actually kind of fueled the, or fanned the flames of unionization was how I took it, that this was a very, very clear signal that things really weren't about to change. It was very, very transparent to the workers what was going on, and they said, okay, that's it. You know, or at least for some of them, they said, that's it. We're moving forward with unionization because we see more of the same. We see that this is just going to continue to get worse for our position. Sorry, Ralph, go ahead.
What I think was interesting, both you and Demetrius emphasized that pay raises as perhaps a bribe or perhaps a tit for tat for non-unionized, for not voting for the union, which is an interesting way to see it. And I don't disagree. Later in the movie, that you see the same manager gets up. It's the Chinese president, Jeff Liu, and he says, "Oh, we're going to have an award for the 10 best workers, and they're going to get to go to China on this vacation." And you could look at that on the one hand as a bribe or something transparent. It's possible, but it's also possible he's trying to do what. Both of you talked about, he's trying to motivate people. He's trying to provide some extrinsic motivation and recognition of a job well done. And you do see some people, you never quite know about this when someone's talking and he's not really on the camera and they're showing people in the audience. You never quite know, was that like a fire alarm meeting or something where people have these long faces or is it actually during that physical meeting? Because usually they only have one camera. But there were people smiling at that announcement. And so perhaps it was transparent. This was after the union vote, or perhaps they're trying to get the hang of it, of this, how to motivate people with these awards or activities. And it's not clear, but that this idea that they could have been doing that, I thought it's worthy of exploration about what is the value of the extrinsic motivation and do you really expect it all to come from intrinsic commitment to company, commitment to country, or what's the role those things play?
Yeah, and this is actually highly illustrative and kind of helps looking at Herzberg's two-factor theory. Because in there, Herzberg says that, well, okay, for motivation, you have two factors, hence the name of the theory. You have the hygiene factors that are not encouraging, but don't make employees unmotivated, and that has to do with getting what is perceived to be fair pay for one's job and being in a safe environment. And then you have the motivators, which is stuff like that, like vacations to Shanghai. And Herzberg said that motivators do not work in the absence of hygiene factors. So you can offer as many vacations, company hoodies, whatever you want. But if the workplace is underpaid, unsafe, if the turnover is high, effectively, if the hygiene factors are not present, then that is not going to do anything. And this is basically an illustration of that, this meeting, that we know that employees are pretty unhappy with how they're treated. The pay is low, and while that's not necessarily the cause for unionization for them, it is a issue of concern. And so the announcement of the Shanghai trip with the sky pool at 55th floor really doesn't land all that much.
Yet, but on the other hand, it is interesting to see how the Chinese are motivated. It seems to me that they have a kind of sense of mission, that they have to go to the USA and show that they are better, and they show that their processes are better, their output are better, and it looks like they are trying to assert the, maybe some kind of power, superiority. In fact, the CEOs, the new CEOs say this on some moment on the movie. So because they are there, we already said, because they are there underpaid, they are ripped off from China. And so they are there to accomplish a mission, and they don't know if they are going back.
Let me ask a question about the two-factor theory. So if we're applying that to this particular case, essentially, do we see the president is trying to use motivators because that's the limit of his authority? That's, you know, essentially he can do surface-level changes by providing simple things like these benefits, like these packages or whatever, but is essentially prevented from getting into anything that would be considered a deeper change within the organization, which gets into what sounds like the hygiene factors. Like he wouldn't dare change, transform the organization to something that really matches American worker culture. He's essentially either prevented or he's preventing himself from going that far. So he's limited to, it seems like he's limited to those motivating factors. Am I kind of catching this right?
Well, I was going to say, he may not be limited to them. In other words, his power may not be constrained as such. However, I think if you're going to go in there and reorganize a factory, that's hideously difficult and takes a long time and there's a great deal of risk. So you could understand why, even if he weren't limited, that's not the path he would go down, because it's hard to do and the outcome's uncertain. So it's much easier, and you see this many times in employee management relations, where the managers focus on what they can do that's quick and easy, because it's quick and easy. And those other things, they just push off. And you see that whether it's in reducing regulations or providing more autonomy or redesigning production lines. I mean, sometimes they're hard physically, and sometimes they're hard to do. And that's why these kind of simple things or coming back from China and telling all your employees to line up in a line, it they're so attractive because of their ease of implementation. They may not work at all, but they're attractive to managers.
I think there's also an issue to consider that, you know, he is managing two very different sets of ontologies there at work. So you have the American part and you have the Chinese part. So what may be a hygiene factor for one, like a positive hygiene factor for one, may be a negative hygiene factor for the other. And what may be a motivational factor for one may actually be a significant negative hygiene factor for the other. So, for example, one of the in the two-factor theory, one of motivators, so things that build on top of hygiene factors, is the variety of work, how interesting the work is itself. So that is something that Americans clearly alluded to in the film as having a problem with, that the work isn't varied enough. There was a guy saying that he's just basically doing the same thing over and over again, which again harkens back to Taylorism. Now, for Chinese, that seems to be something that is perhaps desirable, because they specialize and they just do that thing, and they get very good at it, and that becomes their value proposition as an employee. Not that they are actually in a position to propose anything, but, you know, for the sake of what I'm saying. And so he's stuck in this position where I'm not sure if there is a way to uniformly manage this workforce to any kind of positively developmental effect, because what you can do for the benefit of one can really upset the other, and vice versa. And because he's fundamentally responsible to the chairman, he invariably has to land on the side of the Chinese, the other in this case.
Yeah, I agree that maybe those conflicts aren't reconcilable. And I really liked your observation that what may be a hygiene factor for one or a positive factor for one is negative for the others. And you actually do see that where the Chinese just follow directions. Yeah, they know it's hard, but they want to know what to do and just do it over and over again and get really good at it. And Wong talks about that, the furnace engineer, about how he's developed and how he likes the work. And now his is probably a special case because they have lots of interesting problems and things he has to troubleshoot. But the Americans say, I want to know why. I want to know why I'm doing this. And at one level, you could look at that as, okay, the Americans just want all this liberty and everything explained to them. But there's quite a bit of research in innovation and knowledge work that suggests the importance of the why is, if you want to take the manufacturing to another level and improve things like the Japanese and Toyota, that that workers have to know the whys, because they're not able to suggest improvements unless they understand why they're doing what they do now. And therefore, detailed understanding of the process and the whys behind the steps are crucially important to making them better. And I don't know that the Chinese are in that phase, or at least this illustration it reflects that phase. And yet that is one of those fundamental conflicts of industrial management, scientific management, and then knowledge work. That there's that gap there. And then there's an open question about whether you can transition to knowledge management or knowledge work very well if you don't have that outlook that employees need to know.
So we go back to the Lawrence and Losh episode. And so the importance of integrations, because the most challenging thing that they are facing is how to make these people work together. And so the way of communication is the big problem. So there is, and this leads to problems on the line in the product. So, and how you can improve that? How can you improve this integration among all their workers?
Well, what I wonder is how would this have been different if, for example, the Fuyao, instead of going to an established building in a place where you have an established worker base, and instead set up the factory as kind of like a new facility in a place that didn't have the same history? Because part of what I think was a challenge for, you know, the motivation of the workers was that the workers themselves, the American workers themselves, recognized the delta between what their experience was in GM. When they had all of this variance of work, there was very strong meaning, et cetera. And then moving into a different work setting within the same location where they are being, you know, treated or they're looked upon as doing the same thing over and over, where that delta is familiar to them. If, for example, you put this plant in some other location, recruited a younger workforce without the same, well, without the same level of work experience, who might be motivated or might understand their place in the workplace as more similar to the Chinese workers, would you have had less of a culture clash? I know that's a counterfactual question, but it's, you know, you wonder if perhaps this was brought on just by simply where they decided to set up the factory and what kind of workers they were recruiting in from the American side.
I was going to say, I have two observations about that, and then I want to hear about Demetrius and Spaces. First is that, Tom, you've captured the chairman's comments at the very end of the movie. He says, when they're talking about headcount and workers, and he says, we need to bring in younger workers. and there's a lot tied up in that, but I think that's essentially what you were, a strategy you were articulating, not necessarily as good or bad, but that's what he was talking about. And then I think this idea of siding the factory in a new place, greenfield installation, is exactly what the Japanese car manufacturers have tended to do. I don't know about their other factories, but they've gone to the South, places that are not heavily unionized or right-to-work states, which in the U.S. means you don't have to be a member of the union to work at a particular organization. And they've done just, I think, what you're talking about. And their challenges have been great, but perhaps different than in this case. So I think it's a really interesting case study of what happens when you take the particular approach they did.
Yeah, and we should really not underestimate how powerful spaces are for collectives of people. And this thing, Tom, that you said about, well, what effect did taking a factory where many of the workers that would later join them have worked at previously had on hampering change, or at least on slowing down integration. I just could not be reminded of work by Maureen Halbach on how collectives remember through spaces and the just the importance of physical surroundings to how groups identify themselves and how they think about themselves. And he has this illustration in one of his works of a blackboard. And he says that spaces are not like blackboards. They on a blackboard, you can write something and you can erase it, and you can write something brand new and you can erase that. And blackboard doesn't care. It doesn't remember what was written on it before. But people do. And in fact, people imprint on the spaces, and spaces imprint on the people, and especially on collectives of people. How groups of people think, where they belong or where they don't belong, or even why, has a lot to do with physical spaces. He has examples of things like old hotels that continue to be used only because of where they're located. So an old building that was built as a stagecoach station is still used, not because it's a great hotel, but because of where it is and because of the surroundings that it shapes. And so here as well, at the beginning, there was an interview with this American worker who spent quite a bit of time working at the GM plant, and he highlighted that the factory building had these columns that support the roof, and each of them is numbered, kind of like in a car park, to identify where something is in this building. And that hasn't been changed. So they built up a new glass factory around the same floor layout. Maybe it's a standard industrial design thing, I don't know. Point is that the numbers were the same. And he said that, well, people come up to me and they say, well, I still get lost. And he responded that I never get lost. I know exactly where I am, because he has this mnemonic imprint from way back when. And so when Fuyao comes in to this town in Ohio and sets up a new factory, and they bring in a new product, and they bring in new people, so the Chinese, it's not actually new, because a large portion of their workforce and of the community that surrounds that particular building already has a really embodied memory of that particular space. And so they come into it not as new employees coming into a new factory, they come into it with a sense of identity and a sense of belonging and the type of memory that comes with, you know, coming back to your childhood home, for example, even though it may be repainted and someone else might live there and your room is no longer your room, you very viscerally feel almost chemical changes that go through you as you walk through those same doors and rooms and corridors. And so it is here that maybe setting up in a new, completely brand new spot would have reset that to an extent.
Yeah. Now, what you bring up also reminds me of this one scene in which a particular worker was complaining about space being taken away from the lunch area, or for an eating space or a meeting space for the workers, and reallocated to additional production. So, I'm definitely seeing your point and agreeing with it. It's not just the physical structure. It's also the way in which the American workers understood the utilization of the space, such as you have space for production, space for other functions, and there's sort of like an understanding of what is sufficient in each of those to have a what would be an effective or a satisfying work experience, and that seems to be a clash with how the Chinese perhaps view the same factors.
Well, and there was that woman who observed in that one space, there was only one entrance. And she was concerned from a safety point of view. And like Dimitris said, it was like this imprint of what a space means to her. And wasn't clear that that would have been a problem, but to her it was.
I don't know if that's necessarily the same thing, but what Tom said, that for sure was that it's an identity impacting factor, that if this is where the cafe was back then, there's a connection with memory and with a part of this person's self-identification with that space, and you take it away, you inadvertently or deliberately attack that part of that person's understanding of the self and understanding of where they fit within this collective.
Right. It may not be the same. I was just thinking about it in terms of her sense of what safety was reflected in what she thought the space should be or what she saw in the space. And so it's not quite the same thing, but I do think it's an impact of the space on her sense of safety that she needed in the work.
Yeah, of course. We understand the world by touching it and by moving in it, right? If all three of us find ourselves in a room with some hazard and only one entrance at the far end, even if nothing happens, still feels a bit eerie, right?
Right.
Yes, I don't know if I get it right, the idea of space, but the difference between the Chinese plant and the American plant reminds me of the discussion that we had about contingency theory, especially Joe and Woodward, because we are working with the same product, the same end product, and the same technology and the same process, and they achieve different results. And because when Woodward is talking, using as example the importance of technology for a variance of the output and the efficiency of organization, we now have the example of the same technology leading to different results. And this because of people learning how to work with the technology, the problems of technological transfer too. So many types of issues, and when you are working with the same technology in a different space, in a different country, in a different culture, in a different regulations too.
Yeah, I think it's it may be worth spending a couple of moments here to talk in more depth about the segment of the film where they brought the American managers with the camera crews following and visited the main Fuyao plant, because they're really, you know, this is really where the contrast was so significant. We only talked about, you know, we talked about the regimentation of the Chinese workers, etc. But I think it's also worth mentioning the New Year's celebration, where the Chinese New Year celebration that the Americans attended, and how, for example, there's a show put on with children, with it's very showy, very flashy, very, very highly produced, in which the organization values are expressed as essentially part of the skit, this production. You know, the songs are all about the values that the company holds. And the children are dressed in metaphoric costumes, I guess would be put it. It's kind of like reminds me of how the Chinese nation put on the Olympics. It was the same very highly choreographed, very flashy, very powerful display. But this one was really focused on reinforcing cultural values. And similarly, the factory was, at least what we saw of the buildings and whatnot, were all very, very much new, and they were built with production in mind. Whereas, you know, by adapting to a older building, they had to make some adaptations in order to put all the equipment in the way they wanted, which led them to have to tinker with it for a period of time.
Yes, it's interesting because the song that you mentioned was about lean manufacturing and how this is, and how they are preparing themselves for the future. This is actually a song about, I think it was something about digital transformation and lean manufacturing is the future, is something like that. And one thing that interests too, because in the plan there is all the photos of the Chinese presidents. And they said how the company and the state is something like one entity working for something greater than that, not only to make glass. They make glass for something more important than only the profit. And this is a value that I think is cherished a lot in the Chinese plant.
Right, it's like it's a calling. Or a mission in life, whereas they criticize the Americans and say, well, the Americans just work for money. And you can't help but notice that stark difference in those ceremonies in China. And in fact, there was that one American who had to leave the room because he was overcome by emotion. A bunch of people rushed out to see if he was okay or what the problem was. And he said, no, it's just overwhelming what I'm seeing.
I mean, yeah, you could take it that way. But I mean, the whole thing with unitarism of Fuyao's employees in particular and Chinese society in general, but I would not buy that as anything authentic. There are elements in the film, I kind of a bit struggle to remember now the exact scenes, where you get a glimpse into the dissatisfaction of Chinese workers, and I think maybe sometimes even the dissuasion with this party line. It's just the, you know, we know from history how the Soviet Union turned out, and in to a large extent why. And yeah, it's the disconnect between what was said and what was done was a big, big part of that. And I think this is what we see here, because the scene that Leonardo mentioned with five presidents of China and how the company is really in distinct from the state and blah, 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 that was recounted by the guy who was meant to be a labor union representative for Chinese employees, who is also the brother-in-law of the chairman of the company. So, I mean, okay, but also, how much can you really take that at face value?
Well, right, you don't know what the workers actually feel when they're singing the songs and performing on stage. So that's superficial at best, I agree. And you would expect him to say that. So we can't really know how heartfelt it is, but it is the image they want to portray, that there's no distinction and separation between the group, the party, the union, and even the individuals. There's no difference of opinion or different interests. Whereas in America and Western culture, that difference is very important, and we celebrate that, and we emphasize that. So you're right, Demetrius. There's no way to know for sure how strongly people accept that, and I think you do get hints that there's maybe some other ideas when they talk about how long they've been away from their children, or that they don't get to see their children very much. I mean, there's something going on when they bring that up, but you don't know how much that impacts them.
And I mean, images are powerful, which is why they're being replayed so much. If you sit down and you watch the same film for long enough, that's going to become your reality. And what is interesting one of the many, many, many interesting things that we see in connection with that is how some of the Chinese foremen or line managers or whatever they were, what they're willing to do for the sake of that image. So one thing that came up in part one, I think, was when a Chinese foreman seemed genuinely baffled that you cannot order American employees to work overtime, because that's what they do in China. Yeah, and that's perfectly normal. And in fact, if you do not do this, I don't know if he said that, but the implication was almost that you're a disloyal part of the company. So bad stuff. And then there was another one where a Chinese foreman, maybe same guy, I don't remember, maybe different guy, was showing the camera crew pictures on his phone of unionization activists. So he was going around photographing people who were American workers who were petitioning for unionization, and he shows a picture of this guy, and then the next picture of himself hugging this guy, and he says, "Oh, like, see how great we get along," and then he just kind of looks into the camera and says, "He'll be gone in 2 weeks," and then
right,
yeah, that is, and he said a few other things that really kind of echo well with what we know of the contemporary Chinese security apparatus. But then the final part that kind of rounds this off nicely was when the union voting came through, right? And unionization was defeated about 2-1 or something like that.
Right.
And they show this young Chinese worker on his phone or some voice over IP software talking to someone, and he says that we won, there will be no union, aren't we awesome. And then they show Americans who are sad and so on and so forth, but you can't not think at that point that what is this person's perspective and actual degree of reflexivity about what has actually happened and the role that they played in it. But because the image is constantly reinforced, written on the walls, even with grammatical errors, and just constantly played on TVs. Remember, there was this scene where an American employee said that they keep playing these clips on a loop of Chinese children and families playing happily, and that obviously they cannot resonate to that because they're not Chinese, they're American. So they just this corporate imagery being constantly fed down their throats over and over and over again.
Yeah, that missed the, that bypassed the "when in Rome, do as the Romans" filter the chairman wanted.
And I mean, it also raises questions of workplace surveillance, right? So in our societies, unionization is a right. It's enshrined in law in basically all Western democracies that workers have the right to collective representation, because we've already been through this. We know what are the implications of. But right. Because of this highly unitarist philosophy of the organization, where any kind of conflict or any kind of dissent is seen as counterproductive and dysfunctional, here you basically have organized resistance to unionization just because it is different. So the scene with the young Chinese guy, I would not bet any money that he really understands what's going on there. Maybe he does, didn't seem that way to me. But because it's pictured as the other, and they're bringing in consultants to dissuade people from unionizing, and then it's like, yes, we won because we are we and they are they.
Right, he saw it as just a we-they conflict is what it seemed like by looking at what he said and his actions. So one of the areas of research I think is interesting to that the movie touches on, but is worth further investigation, is problem management. They because of the nature of the movie and what they were doing, they really couldn't go into much detail about that. And I'm not even talking about the employee relations problem management with the union consultants. I'm talking about when they're having industrial technical problems. And sometimes you saw the Chinese just giving orders, just go do this, go carry this thing here. And the doesn't seem interested when the worker says, I can't do it. And he says, oh, she's just complaining, or she never does what I want. And then I think where Rob, the furnace supervisor, was talking about, yeah, we have these difficulties and we have to get together. And Wong says, yes, but it's hard to integrate the ideas. It's a Schein said that if you really want to understand the culture of an organization, watch them work on problems, because that's when they basically go to the cultural touchstones of how they function. And I think that's you see a little bit of that in the front end of the movie, but it's certainly worth something that there's a lot of literature on about problem management and difficulties in producing highly technical, capable outputs. And in high reliability, that comes up all the time. This idea about, well, when you have a problem, what you see in high reliability organizations is that Wyke and Sutcliffe noted is egalitarianism. In the midst of problems, it's not your position in the hierarchy that's important. It's what you can contribute and how people have different ideas of what creates more reliability. And that's a challenge in problem management when, if the culture is, well, everybody's going to default to their constructs of management and employees, and then you have the language challenge. And so that to me is a very interesting aspect of the movie that they're only able to touch on a little bit.
Yes, and also it seems that by the end of the movie, the Chinese management maybe is thinking that, well, all these problems and all the human relations problems will be solved by automation. So it's a matter of time until we replace everything here for robots. So human will not be a problem anymore because they are counting how many people can be replaced. So this is a temporary matter until robots assume their role. And actually it's how the film ends, discussing how we will solve the dismissal of mass of workers by automation. So it's one of the great challenges of the future.
Yeah, they did also say that the company has been pulling a profit since 2018, which is around the time, I guess, that the robots were installed. And that the firm was down to a much smaller percentage of workers. So now there was, you know, at the time in which the film was made, there were only 2,200 workers. It didn't say, you know, what kind of workers, though. One would have to presume that the workforce had to undergo significant change to bring in different skills in order to run the robots. That would be interesting to know just what happened with the original the original workforce, how much of it actually stayed throughout the entire time in which this documentary was made.
Well, they did say they had quite a bit of turnover. And I think what you're getting at, Tom, is this, that in the midst of a turnover, the skills mix changes that would occur as a result of automation, which I think would be very interesting as well to study.
Well, I have a question with respect to robotization to the chairman. So what happens to the ethos of the purpose of life is work when you automate and introduce robots into the workplace?
Yes. Ooh, interesting. What? Yeah. But do you get a new purpose or what? Because the robot's doing the work.
He wants to be the owner of robots.
There you go.
Yeah.
Or the maker of robots.
Yeah.
It goes back to this communism without communism thing, right? So you have some kind of a guiding direction that was outlined, you know, by a couple of guys in the late 19th century. And then you have this Protestant ethic on steroids that is profit oriented. And I don't know, that's someone asked, I think you, Ralph, at some point, you know, where is this going? Like, it's too early to tell what's going to happen to industrial relations in China. Well, maybe that's a glimpse of it. Well, the drive for efficiency stays. It's just that the most efficient thing is not a trained, detached worker. It's going to become a robot. And then what? You know, what happens to all the people who are meant to, you know, to have a point of life as work? And they're out of work now.
Yes, and just to mention there, as Dimitri is saying, we don't know for sure what's the ology of this thing, but the movie portrays this kind of new power conflict that we are seeing in the world. And just to mention that, in the end, we have that robot that's made from a company that originally was for Germany, and now it's a Chinese company. So we don't know the ideology, but we know how the things are being operating in practical ways. So there is this amount of investment on automation, on artificial intelligence technology that in the end shows some kind of our control society by algorithms and so on. So we don't know where it's going, but the features of this, what will be, it's already here.
Well, I mean, Wong, right? Wong, the furnace guy, I think he provided a bit of a glimpse in it when he said that back in the day, you know, people of his generation, all they wanted was to have enough money to feed themselves and their family and raise their children. Well, now the consumption class is growing, the purchasing power of Chinese is growing, workers specialize. As they work with more sophisticated technology, they become more skilled, they have to earn more as a result. And, well, we know that innovation is driven by necessity. So if a company like that we saw in this documentary is willing to invest into robots, which are not cheap, that means it makes a business sense to do so, which means that the Chinese employees are kind of, as I kept saying throughout this whole episode, are just a few decades behind their American counterparts. And yeah, they're going to become too expensive at some point as well. And they're going to be replaced by robots that make commercial sense to maintain in their place. And well, there you go. Maybe the industrial relations revolution is not all that far off for that part of the world as well as these changes come.
Well, it's interesting because you just don't know where that's going to, we can't know where it's going to go, but it's a fascinating organizational studies management science question is how do they manage it now? And then what, not necessarily the changes that we're likely to see, but what do these portend for the future? Because both you and Leonardo talked about that. And if your whole model, your entire country's economic model is built on creating this enormous industrialized workforce that you're taking from the fields, just like every other country in the world did, and yet you're moving to automation, which was unthinkable to the level that we're doing it today when we industrialized in the 20s and 30s. I mean, we did many things, but you weren't really replacing workers. And how that change gets negotiated and managed, and the implications for management approaches for working with the people and transitioning the workforce. It's a really interesting idea. So from a human relations point of view, it's a fascinating concept of or area of study.
Just to mention that looking for some sociological studies, you always see this movement from industrialization, urbanization, this kind of thing. This all leads to conflict. And when you build some society, not build, but when you are dealing with this kind of achievement values, like Wong say, we run it all, there will be conflict in society, and then government will be called to solve. And one of the problems that I always had when we are dealing with this process is labor problems. So Brazil was like this when we are talking about the middle of the last century, because all people come from the countryside to the cities, and it starts urbanization problems and the unemployment, all these kind of issues. When you have this kind of industrialization, some people start to want more and more and more, and you have to provide in one way or another. This is a challenge.
Yeah, and you know, it's also interesting that if you go to see what academic jobs are available in business schools in that part of the world, maybe you will not, but I feel like I'm looking at the 1920s, because it's all about management science. So there are almost no faculty positions for things like knowledge management or industrial relations or HRM. It's almost single-mindedly oriented at basically scientific management in one way or another. And that's now, you know, that's happening at the moment. I think, yeah, I mean, I may be wrong. Again, haven't had to look for in those places for a bit of time, luckily, but when I did, that was the case for sure. There's Toyota production system specialist areas, lean manufacturing and such, Six Sigmas and all that, and it's basically management science. It's production. It's how do we optimize resources, workers included.
This reminds me that I read something once that one of the most famous readers of Taylor was Lenin. Yeah, so he said that the problem of the Soviet Union is the one of efficient, so you have to implement the Taylorism on their manufacturing.
Well, that makes sense for that time period, because I mean, Russia is not known for being a industrial powerhouse now, and less so in, you know, early 1900s. And do remember that Taylor was not espousing these things. He was saying that, well, we need to train workers so that they are more effective, so they don't break stuff, but also that they earn more as they work. That was kind of the guiding principle. And yeah, I can totally see how that would kind of align with that time period. But that part stayed as the rest moved forward, and now there's this perverted version of that we see in this documentary, where efficiency is the one and only goal, and it's very much a tail wagging the dog kind of a situation now.
And the other thing that's interesting is that a dead end where you say, okay, well, I can optimize this process and optimize this process, and I can bring in robots, but if, as you say, Demetrius, they're not really pursuing knowledge work, knowledge studies, to innovate or develop other kinds of things, do you reach a dead end in improvement that way? We don't know, but in some ways, Soviet Union's manufacturing, you know, copied all the essence of Taylorism and the regimentation industrialization, but never went into, at least in certain areas, went into knowledge work. And so was that a dead end? I don't know, but it's an interesting way to look at it.
Yes, interesting, because I kept thinking about this in, like they say, one of the aims of the manufacturing of the chairman was innovation, and I was thinking, we have this kind of a lot of studies about innovation. How can innovation flourish in a organization that is so standardized? Everything is very secure, but nobody talks to anybody. So it's, how can we talk about innovation in that terms? I'm not saying that they won't be innovative company. What I'm saying is that what we have of studies about innovation is that saying that we have to have open cultures, open knowledge, open source. And what we see there, it's the opposite of this.
Well, it's operational innovation, right? They're just refining existing process. They're not encouraged to introduce new things or critique what's already there. In the awards ceremony, the Chinese New Year, remember they recognized two guys for something along these lines. They took their pictures. Yeah.
Yes, it sounds like that kind of corporate innovation that was related with the 20th century, like, you know, a lab that is there innovating and making things. But there's a lot of studies say that the technologies that we are working now, it's different. We have to think about the user of the customer, and so the innovation process goes. So I think we are here, we are studying something, and that they are doing other thing different. So let's see what's the end result of this.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, they're using innovation as sort of like an aspirational theme, a cultural glue, if you will, as opposed to, you know, embodying it the way that we would understand it.
Yes.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, so it's a theme that's aimed both externally, but in this case, it's also aimed internally to the organization.
I think a shameless plug for what we do here, talking about organizations, I think this movie and our discussion illustrate how you can take some movie, or in this case, a documentary that's entertaining and interesting and thought-provoking in its own right, and break it down into interesting management themes and conflicts and struggles and illustrations of research that we've seen in the past, and then talk about, well, how would you study this more, or what are the implications for future management? And that's actually one of the things that makes doing the podcast fun, is that the idea that you can take this movie that works at one level and take it even deeper in a management science or organizational theory way.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now, did you know that we are quickly approaching our 5th anniversary? 5 years and still going strong. We invite you to be part of the celebration. Go to our pages on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, or our website for information about how you can contribute to a series of special releases we will run in October 2020. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time here on Talking About Organizations.